Welcome to the Space Show, Peter.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Your work bridged the Cold War, the ending of the Cold War and the beginning of Glasnost, when you were deciphering the signal format from the GLONASS satellites. How did that come about?
Well, we had originally been working with GPS itself for many years, and we knew that the Russians had an equivalent. And of course, the thought occurred to us, was GLONASS as good as GPS? Could we possibly use it to navigate with and compare with GPS? Even in those days, we thought maybe there would be some chance of some form of collaboration between the two systems, and if so, maybe we could help. But our interest primarily in the early days was technical, of course, and it was a puzzle because we didn't have enough information to be able to acquire the GLONASS signal, so we had to go about finding out for ourselves using our own facilities and whatever brain power we have.
When you first began, there's a fair amount of misunderstanding about what you were doing, wasn't there? Some of your students, for example, rather regarded you as sort of a Russian ally.
Well, when we started, the students knew that I used to tell them on many occasions about what was going on in our work with the Russian systems, and they used to regard me as a little bit of a red. I remember on the occasion when Andropov died, there was a notice on my blackboard saying, "Have a good time at the funeral." And of course you'll remember that he was succeeded by Chernenko, and of course it wasn't very long before a second message appeared saying, "Have a good time at this funeral as well." And just as well, at that point, they decided to elect a younger man who wasn't likely to have me go there for a third time.
And that younger man, of course, was Gorbachev, and he brought about Glasnost. And how did that affect your work and your contact then, which I presume only began at that time with the Soviet Union?
Oh, yes. We had been attempting to make contact with our counterparts within the Soviet Union for many years. We had written letters to the embassy. We had tried to contact the Academy of Sciences. We had tried to contact various universities. We even tried intermediaries that we knew in Iron Curtain countries, and the result of all of these attempts was a complete blank. We were unable to make contact with any group whatsoever within the Soviet Union, and I think it's perfectly obvious in retrospect why. In those days, any form of contact which didn't go through official circles, it was frowned upon. And of course, once Gorbachev arrived on the scene, as we're now well aware, the whole scene began to defrost. And before long, we were able to make contact with a variety of sources within the Soviet Union. We were able to meet individuals at conferences, and since then, these contacts have flourished, and nowadays we have probably better, we have as good relations with our colleagues in the Soviet Union now, I should say, Russia and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Ukraine and the rest of it, as we have with other countries in the West, with countries in the West. But it took time, of course.
Was the work on GLONASS done just by Russian academies, or was it done throughout the former Soviet Union?
Oh, no. The, must remember that GLONASS is a military system, just like GPS is an American military system. But it being a military system, of course, meant that access to information about GLONASS was very limited. And another thing which one only appreciates having been within the Soviet Union is that even groups which are involved with GLONASS are very compartmentalized in their knowledge about the system. They operate on the need-to-know principle. You will find even senior individuals within the program who know little about other parts of the program. People have often said to me, you probably know more about the overall aspects of the GLONASS system than anyone in the Soviet Union. I wouldn't quite go that far, but I now know what they meant. The compartmentalization which they have operated over there has, I think, been detrimental to their progress with the system.
A classic case of the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing?
Absolutely. And it was done deliberately. And in fact, the whole mentality of the Russian people in those days was such as to encourage that kind of attitude. You knew what you were supposed to know, and you didn't inquire about what you were not supposed to know could get you into trouble. Even amongst the most senior people. I've reason to believe that that situation is changing.
When you first went to the Soviet Union, obviously to find out more about GLONASS, you went with a group, and I believe you were heading towards one institution and you got hijacked off to another one.
Oh yes, it was very interesting. I was a member of a Western group which consisted of mainly Americans from industry and from commerce. There were people from the airlines, from the receiver manufacturers, there were people from the Federal Aviation Authority, and a few others. And we were there to discuss cooperation between the two systems, the GPS and the GLONASS system. This was about a year and a half ago, and it was in Leningrad, a beautiful city, I might say. And we were told on one morning that we were being taken to see one of their research institutions, one that we knew of, and one or two of the members had already been there. The visit was postponed by an hour on the morning when we were due to leave, and when we got on the bus, to our amazement, we were told we weren't going to this institution, we're going to another one. And when we were told what the other one was, none of us had ever heard of it. And it turns out that this other one is one of the major research and development labs in the GLONASS program within the Soviet Union. Now, the explanation is quite simple. They, the people in the second institution, were part of the that group of organizations which were not allowed to have any contact with the West whatsoever. None whatsoever. But in the weeks before our visit, the situation had become sufficiently relaxed that they had, yes, been allowed to have contacts. And we were very lucky on that particular morning, to our astonishment, to be taken there. There were about 20 of us in the group. We were taken into a pretty large boardroom, and we sat down on both sides of a very long table, and the director of the institute came with their translator, and he spoke to us for about 20 minutes, and he explained that the new situation that his institute, that we'd never heard of, built GLONASS receivers. The institution also builds atomic frequency standards, which we were allowed to see, I might say, both the receivers and the atomic frequency standards. He told us that his institution was the primary institution for Western groups to cooperate with, and he left us in no doubt that he was very anxious to develop contacts with us, not with me, but with the American commercial organizations there. He then said that he was prepared to answer any questions that we were prepared to ask. And of course, in the old days, that would have meant the old blank wall response. You would have asked a question and you really wouldn't have got an answer. My colleagues at the meeting knew that I knew more about the GLONASS system than most in the West, and so they encouraged me to put a few pointed questions to them, and I did. In fact, I asked them one or two naughty questions, which if I asked them in the United States, would have met with a pretty frosty rebuff. And to my astonishment, he answered them. For example, I asked him how many master control stations they had for the GLONASS system within the Soviet Union. Now this, in the old days, that would quite definitely have been a military secret. And he would have been prosecuted for answering it. And to my astonishment, he said, two. Just like that, straight out. So I said, well, I rather suspect the first one is in Moscow. Where is the second one? Oh, he said, it's in Soviet Central Asia. So I said, well, could you tell me exactly where in Soviet Central Asia? And he said, yes, it's in Lake Balkhash. So I said, where's Lake Balkhash? He said, come with me. And he and I left the meeting. I think most of the others thought that I was about to visit the Lubyanka. But no, I was shown into an enormous boardroom with an equally enormous map on the wall, and he raised a large pointer and he said, there, and pointed to it. Now, the master control stations, of course, are the stations which have ultimate control on all signals up to the satellite and all signals down from the satellite. So they have the power of life and death over a satellite. And I was very surprised that he was prepared to tell me where it was. He also, to my astonishment, when I suggested that he might like to acquire all the data that we had measured on the GLONASS system, because we were most anxious to cooperate with them, he said yes, he would very much like me to send it to him, and that he would send me all of his. Now, you just don't do that when you're running the kind of institution that he is. At least I wasn't. I was totally taken aback by this offer, which went far further than any offer that you would have received in any other country. And in fact, since then, we have been cooperating very well with them. We have been cooperating with other institutes in Moscow, where the GLONASS system was designed. We are on very friendly terms with one or two of the people in Krasnoyarsk, which is in Soviet Central Asia. That's where they build the GLONASS satellites. And not last but not least, with the Soviet State Time and Frequency Service, which is in Mendeleeva, near Moscow. And we are working together with that latter group in doing time transfer measurements on GLONASS against our own standards, to try and come to some understanding as to how the long-term stability of the clocks, as we call them, the primary oscillators that eventually determine how accurate and how precise the system is going to be. We are working with them to see just how stable they are in the very long term. It's a very important question which has to be answered if one is to consider, A, the use of these satellite systems as navigation aids, and even possibly more important, how to combine our measurements of the satellites of one system with the satellites of another system. Because each of the GPS and GLONASS systems obviously uses a different time reference. One of them's in the United States, the other one's in the Soviet Union. They're both damn good clocks. But the question is, how do they compare? And knowing how they have compared in the past, can we predict how well they will behave in the future? Because this information will need to be provided to the navigator should he wish to navigate with satellites from either system, or should I say both systems. And this is the plan, of course, which the aviation community has for these systems. They are hoping to use satellites of the American system and the Russian system without regard to which particular satellite they're using. They will only base their choice on technical arguments. Is the satellite in the right position at the right time? If it is, we'll use it. But if you're using satellites from the same system, they have a common reference. If you're using two of one and two of the other, then they, each pair of two has a different time reference, and you better know the difference. And you only can know the difference if you're told what the difference is. And you can only be told if the predictions of, based on their previous behaviours, is sufficiently well established for you to be able to do that. And this is part of the experiment that we are doing with the people at the Soviet State Time and Frequency Service. You know, some people say to me, timing, who needs timing? We're talking about navigation. But you know, via the velocity of light, position is range, time is range, free range is this position. So the knowledge of the timing involved is extremely important to the development of both systems.
So a positional and time of, say, a millionth of a second, how far out in navigation would that put you?
Well, a millionth of a second is 300 metres. And we certainly can do a lot better than that. 100 nanoseconds is 30 metres. And one can certainly range to these satellites to a precision a lot better than that. I would say that we can do 50 nanoseconds now without trying very hard. I should mention that these measurements that we've been doing on the time transfer have been combined in such a way that we can compare the time references of the American and the Russian system, and we have been relaying that data to a central coordinating authority which is called the BIPM, which means the Bureau International des Poids et Mesures, if my French is correct, which is in Paris, and they coordinate what is known in physics as UTC, or Universal Coordinated Time. These people have been in the business of coordinating the international time via the systems of atomic clocks used in various laboratories around the world. They've been doing this for years. The advent of satellites, particularly GPS and now GLONASS, has meant that they're able to do this to a far higher precision and accuracy than they have ever done in the past. We are in a fortunate position since we are able to do the measurements on both GPS and GLONASS rather than just one or the other, that we can provide this bridge between the Soviet, or should I say the Russian time system and the American ones, and this information is relayed to the BIPM and used by them to tie in the clocks of the Eastern Bloc countries with the Western blocs. I should say that this whole question of just how precisely one can transfer time has only just started. When I talk about 50 nanoseconds, I mean we can do 50 nanoseconds now without really trying very hard. I mean those involved in the development of receivers for these systems are only beginning to use all the signal accuracy which is available to us. I don't want to get too technical, but one can measure what's called a code phase, which is the measurements we are currently doing, which is fairly crude. But one can supplement these measurements by doing measurements on the carrier phase or on what's called integrated Doppler to refine the measurements so as to make them more and more accurate. One can also measure at two frequencies. I haven't mentioned that there are two frequencies available which allow one to isolate the effects of the ionosphere. So when one says, well, what are these systems fundamental? What are they actually capable of at the end of the day? The answer is very simple. All of these satellites have ultra-precise atomic clocks. All of the signals which are transmitted are referred, synchronized to these atomic clocks. Therefore, one can measure to a precision which is a fraction of the smallest wavelength which is transmitted. And the smallest wavelength transmitted is at a frequency of about 1.6 gigahertz, and that wavelength is 19 centimeters. Now, if one can measure to, let's not claim too much, let's say 10%, that means 1.9 centimeters. In other words, if we really put our minds to it and use all of the signals which are coming down, and we pull out all the stops in the development of the receiver, we can go down to absolute positions which are rather smaller than the 20, 30 meters that I mentioned.
Well, if it's that accurate, you should be able to then measure, say, continental drift and things like that quite easily.
People are planning to do that right now. I will not pretend to you that the design of these receivers is simple. It isn't. It's extremely complex. Because as you develop the accuracy of the measurement and going from, let's say, 100 nanoseconds to 10 nanoseconds, systematic effects which you had been able to neglect when your aim was only 100 nanoseconds suddenly become important, and you have to include them, and there are more of them, and they are not so easy to isolate. When you go from 10 nanoseconds to 1 nanosecond, wow, you even have to consider which part of the antenna are you talking about. You have to take account of the size of your tiny antenna that you're carrying. So the step from a microsecond to 100 nanoseconds was, for GPS, very easy. It would bring tears to the eyes of the people whose responsibility it was to transfer time in the old days. But to go from 100 nanoseconds to 10 nanoseconds is proving difficult, but it will be done. Whether we can go from 10 to 1, let's wait and see. But there are many, many people out there trying, and there are very good applications around in the world whereby one should try.
Over the years, we've seen many improvements in navigation. First, of course, there were the seagoing clocks. Then, of course, radar helped to some extent. How would you rate Navstar and GPS? Navstar and GLONASS?
You mean one against the other, or as a combined system?
As a combined system, in the overall historical sense.
Well, let me tell you what the United States government is planning to do. The United States government has what they call a federal radio navigation plan. And that radio navigation plan encompasses all current navigation aids. I won't go through them, but there are a large number, from non-directional beacons to local navigation systems to a fairly large number of global land-based navigation systems and satellite systems. And their plan is, by the turn of the century, to do away with just about all of them except GPS. They see GPS as providing just about all of the needs that the United States government foresees now and in the future for navigation. And this, I'm not just talking about military applications, I'm talking about civil applications as well. Now, I won't pretend to you that there aren't people who are a little bit skeptical about GPS, and of course there are those around with very good reason who are not very keen on the idea of having one single system of anything, no matter how good it is. I had a friend see me the other day saying, you make one measurement of a quantity, it's really no measurements. You really need a second one, so you can compare it with the first one. Then you maybe start to believe the first one. And maybe maybe GPS stroke GLONASS will never take over completely. I myself don't believe that they ever will remove the need for any other navigation. You try and persuade an airline pilot to remove the inertial navigation system which he has been relying on for these last tens of years, I don't think he'll have it. Remember, the airlines have been flying these for years now, three of them, and they provide excellent navigation facilities for airline pilots. They have their problems, of course, but then some people would argue so does GPS. There will be some form of compromise for a long time to come.
But then again, many of the airline pilots must have looked suspiciously at the initial navigation system when it was first implemented.
Well, that's right. There are those airline pilots, no doubt, who see the drawbacks of INS. But I rather think a majority of them would say, look, let's hold on to INS. Let's try this newfangled GPS at the same time. And let's see how the two work together. Maybe one can complement the other. And in fact, they can. Because INS has the disability that the error in position integrates with time, because it's based on integration of acceleration. They use gyros, as you know. So the error increases in proportional to the length of the flight. With GPS, the error doesn't increase in proportional to the length of the flight. It's the same all the time. But it's bigger at the start of the flight than INS is, and less than INS is at the end. So the airlines are thinking, well, let's use these two together. Let's be clever about it. And what we will do is we will use GPS to calibrate INS every now and again, to reset it, in other words, so that the error which had been integrating all this time is suddenly reset to zero. And then if either GPS or INS fails in the aircraft, they can rely on the other. And this is, in fact, the direction that the airlines will go in for some time to come. Remember, the airlines are thinking of using these what they call GNSS, Global Navigation Satellite System. That means GPS and GLONASS and any other satellite navigation system which can help, one of which is being offered by Inmarsat, I should say. They're thinking of using these for all phases of flight, not just oceanic flight, not just terminal approach, but they're thinking of using them for all phases of landing, including the most stringent of all, which of course occurs in the very worst weather conditions, when the plane is very close to touchdown. The question arises, is GPS or is GNSS at this stage able to provide that kind of accuracy? The answer is almost certainly not. But let's take this one slowly but surely. We will use GPS for the less stringent phases of flight to start with, like oceanic. We will look at it in comparison with INS over a period of time, and when we're good and ready, we'll start to use GPS for more critical areas of flight, and should it prove satisfactory, we will go from there. But the airline community is rightly very, very conservative about this whole question. And of course, the question which occurs to the airlines is, how do I know that the satellite is behaving itself? Because here am I, you're asking me to rely on these four satellites to provide my position. How do I know that all the time I'm using these chaps up there, that they're all behaving themselves? What if I'm getting the wrong timing reference? What if the satellite isn't what he says he is? How do I know? Because I'd rather like to, if you don't mind. And the answer to that question is, you might think, well, it would be a fairly straightforward. It's enormously complicated. It introduces a subject which is known as integrity monitoring. There have to be means of determining whether or not the spacecraft are behaving themselves or not. And steps have to be taken, of course, to do something about it should they not be behaving. And the means whereby this integrity monitoring should take place is a subject of enormous debate and discussion, cooperative, of course, at this time. It's by no means over.
I take it's not just a matter of simply using, say, 5 satellites instead of 4.
No, it's not.
It's not, because the interesting thing is that if you use 5 satellites instead of 4, and only one of the let's say one of the satellites is misbehaving, and let's say you say, well, I've got 5 satellites, I only need 4. The choice of 4 out of 5 means I've got 5 possibilities. I can choose 5 groupings of 4. And so you work out the solution 5 times using 4 different groups of 4 satellites. They will all agree except one. And it's the one which differs which is the right one. Because the satellite which is misbehaving is always part of one of the 4. Sorry, it's always part of 4 of the choice of 5. It's only when you omit it, and the 4 working ones.
No.
It's no use just having 5. Because if you have 5 and one satellite is misbehaving of the 5, you still don't have enough information to work out which of the 5 is misbehaving. Because remember, you need 4 satellites to navigate. If there are 5 available, that means that you have to choose 4 from 5. And of course, you can do that 5 different ways. But remember, the satellite who's misbehaving, he will be part of the 4 that you choose 4 times. Only once will he not be a member. And therefore, you will work out where you are 5 times. You will get agreement in 4 cases, disagreement in 1, and yet it's the disagreement that will be right. And so you have to be careful. You need more than 5. And in fact, to be able to isolate which satellite it is, with certainty, you need 7. I won't go into the details of why you need 7. Now, when you think that at any one time, on any point on the surface of the Earth, you will only be able to see at the most 8. Remember that there are 24 satellites in the entire system. And therefore, since these satellites are roughly 4 Earth radii out, they're about halfway out to geostationary orbit.
That's about 20,000 kilometres.
That's right. You will only be able to see somewhat less than half of them, when you think about it. And in fact, the maximum number you can see is about 8. That doesn't leave much margin for error.
But can't we just solve the problem by putting up more satellites? Instead of having a network of 18 or 24 satellites, just put up 40 or 48.
Except that you have to persuade the taxpayer to pay for them. And this is the bug. The American taxpayer has drawn the line at paying for 24. For a long time, the Americans were restricting themselves to 21 and even 18 at one point. So they're saying, no, we're not paying for any more. So the obvious answer is, well, let's use GLONASS. They've got 24. And of course, to the aviation community, it has the enormous attraction. A, you have 48 satellites. You have double redundancy. And you have 2 independent systems. Those 2 words are loved rightly by the aviation community. Independence and redundancy. Remember that for their perspectives are sometimes hard to imagine. They have to adopt a system for navigation which will guarantee that there will not be a single accident in any flight anywhere in the world for, well, a long time. What figure would you choose? Let's say 8 years? That's a very, very small probability. that we're dealing with here. And therefore, the airlines have to think about not only one spacecraft misbehaving, maybe two. Maybe one GLONASS will be down. Maybe a GPS will be down. Maybe two GPSs will be down. It's happened before. Satellites require to be taken out of service to be looked after. You know, they're a bit like washing machines. Every now and again, they have to be serviced. And supposing you have one out of service and another one fails, that's you've lost two. Getting close. And the airlines are not prepared to even dream of this. They have to be certain, or as certain as they can, that they will have a working system all day, every day, everywhere on the surface of the earth for years. It's a tall order. And this is why, of course, the collaboration between the two systems is extremely important.
And of course, the airlines don't want to pay for it either, do they?
Oh, yes, they do. They don't want to pay for the system which is currently up. But the airlines are unhappy, of course, with the fact that the control of these systems is military. Let's make it perfectly clear. The United States Department of Defense, the DOD, has stated in the clearest possible terms that in a case of national emergency, they reserve the right to switch these signals off. Now, to someone running an airline, that is rather awkward, bad news. They don't like it. They've said they don't like it. They take the position, well, all right, we will accept these systems for the period for which they've been guaranteed, which, by the way, is 10 years in the case of GPS and 12 years in the case of GLONASS. But after that, when I say they, I mean the entire aviation community, are contemplating paying for launching, operating their own independent satellite navigation system. They will pay for it. They won't pay for this one.
When would that be likely to happen?
After the 10 years are over. The 10 years that I'm talking about for GPS, I believe, starts in 94, when the systems are supposed to become fully operational. Remember, we're still some way short of full operational capability. We're still in the pre-operational phase. That should finish. In 1994, it should be right. All systems go. We're ready to release the system. 10 years from that point, the American government are not at this stage prepared to commit themselves. And the airlines are saying, no, well, if this is the line you take, we will plan at this stage to have our own alternative ready to take over 10 years from now. Now, some people say this is a bluff, of course, that they've no intention of doing so. I don't think it's a bluff. I think they've every intention of doing so. They have done the sums. They reckon that there will be enough traffic, enough demand for it, for them to be able to pay for it. You only have to think of the advantages that such a system brings to the airline to realize why they take this position. The benefits to be gained are enormous in savings for the airlines of fuel, and their ability to plan routes, use airport facilities, and the rest of it. They have done their homework, believe me, and they believe that it's worth paying for.
Well, thank you, Peter, for joining us tonight on The Space Show.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.